Hello, everyone. Joshua Gilliland here, one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. With me today is Nari Ely, and we're going to discuss the original Mothra from 1961. Nari, how you doing?
I am actually 100% okay with being known as Mothra Ely. As you well know, Josh, I pride myself to a certain extent on not being a stereotypical female, but in this respect, I am a very stereotypical female. Mothra is my favorite kaiju. I absolutely love Mothra, and I loved this movie.
Before we jump into the legal analysis, why do you think women gravitate towards Mothra?
That is a good question. Maybe it's because it is just such an unconventional kaiju. It's not, so it's the, we just, Josh and I just watched and podcast about Gamera. Mothra is kind of like the opposite. She is definitely not a slugger. She fights, especially if you've seen the newer Godzilla movies, she gets pretty vicious. but she is not a slugger. She doesn't fight by hitting things. with big heavy fists. And so maybe that appeals to women, which that's not normally our style, even when we do decide to fight.
Yeah, it's the big wings, pretty, lots of things.
And she's adorable. I know she's giant and dangerous, but she's also adorable.
There is that. So regardless, popular character, Toho's second most popular monster of all time. So
after right Godzilla, up, I assume?
Yep. So very popular. And again, it's been around since 61. And let's talk about the major legal issues in this movie, because there are
a lot.
Yeah, it's working on the outline while watching was like, my God, there's a lot.
Josh, we talk about sometimes how we wish our law professors use these for issue spotters. Tip for any law professors watching, this is quite the perfect one for an issue spotter. You could find almost anything in here.
Yeah, there's a lot. And you can tell a lot of legal issues from this film. Starting with one of the big ones, kidnapping. We have an expedition to Infant Island because there's some shipwrecked sailors who survive despite the fact they're in an area that's irradiated, kind of like post-Bikini Atoll type nuclear test. And they're fine because the local natives give them berry juice.
It's like juice!
Juice. And let's ignore the HIPAA issues with like having press talking about wanting people's medical files because that ain't okay. No. No, doctors don't do that. No. But we have the bad guy who's known as Nelson, because for some reason Japan likes making fictional countries. And this
right, Relisica, I believe.
Yeah, that's kind of like a mix of Russia and the United States. But they look very American. Very, very American. And with a name like Nelson, okay, that's either U.S. or British.
So they look American. They also, frankly, act a little American if we're talking about the stereotype of acting like cowboys. Nelson eventually ends up on his ranch. And of course, there is later Newkirk City. So this seems to be like a pretty obvious stand.
Yeah, it was like they just didn't want to commit. Do we just outright say the United States and really tick them off or not? So that's
honestly, it was fine. Like there were, like I was saying, it was the cowboy stereotype for sure, but there was also at least some positive things. Like towards the end of the movie, the stand-in for the U.S. government was trying to help the scientists recover the girls. So
Yes, but we'll get to the unpleasant.
Exactly. Sorry. Not to jump ahead.
So Nelson does this expedition with his goons to Infant Island after a scientific expedition, and they go kidnap the twins who are, you know, Smurf size. They speak
adorable.
They sometimes speak in unison. They're the peanuts. They're fun. Adore them. And they're kidnapped, and there are so many problems with what happens because they're kidnapped. The natives show up and Yeah, there's some borderline blackface going on, which is another uncomfortable issue with this film.
Yeah, it was fascinating to see Japanese actors in blackface.
It was just like, dude, did...
I know. It was an unfortunately common phenomenon in Hollywood during this time, and apparently in Japanese film as well, that when you needed to have actors portraying Egyptians, in this case, Polynesian Islanders, you just painted your regular actors.
It is so messed up. But that's an elimination against bias presentation, and we can do that a separate time. Let's just say it's wrong. Don't do
it's
it.
It's definitely awkward. It was very awkward to watch.
You have to talk to your kids about that at some point. It's not okay. Because the peanuts are not painted. So, good. but Nelson's reaction to these natives showing up and they're banging musical instruments together and looking menacing. And Nelson says, well, shoot her way out. And they break out semi-automatic weapons and shoot their way out against unarmed guys. Do you want to talk about some of the legal issues?
There are so many problems here. So we can look at this through two angles. The first is just ordinary, just use of force, right? So, which requires that we analyze whether or not that these, again, I think you're correct in characterizing them as thugs or goons, but, setting that aside for now, whether or not they were justified in shooting the natives who were approaching them. They were approaching them banging rocks together. now, ordinarily, so self-defense is an affirmative defense when you are charged with having, you know, killed someone or attempted to kill someone or hurt someone. What it requires is that you have been in reasonable fear of your life or the lives of others. And that, I think that can vary a little bit depending on the state. And obviously there's different like laws about stand your ground and stuff like that, but just setting that aside, the general rule is you have to be in reasonable fear for your life or the lives of others. It is not, Josh, it is not that you feel creeped out or intimidated. Now, I have a hard time imagining that if Nelson and his goons were brought into court, you know, like a U.S. court under charges of having killed these natives, that any jury would ever buy that they were in fear for their lives because they were being approached by villagers banging small rocks together.
So you guys had automatic weapons and you were kidnapping their three apple tall girls. And you open fired. Do we have the facts correct? You don't get a free pass on that one. That crosses the line into murder. On the flip side, the natives would have been justified in using lethal force to rescue the girls being kidnapped because they're kidnapped. So use of force would be appropriate for...
It's valid, though, to ask about whether deadly force would have been authorized, but it does not appear, again, that the locals were threatening deadly force. They were surrounding them and perhaps, you know, trying to get the girls back, which would have been justified. They could have detained Nelson and his men until, you know, whatever goes for their law enforcement, which might be Mothra, would arrive. But in any event, yeah, the other thing is that there's also a duty to retreat in most states. It is not clear to me that they're actually so surrounded here that there's no option just to go, but let's assume that they're surrounded, sure. But either way, I don't think it's gonna fly. The one other angle I wanted to bring up here is, of course, Nelson and his men are not on their home country. They're not even in Japan. This is a random island in the Pacific, previously unknown to man. Now, granted, this has not been therefore recognized as a nation yet by any other nation, but nonetheless, typically if a private citizen, again, these are not uniformed soldiers, they're goons. If a private citizen is off in another country and commits a crime under the laws of that country, they're subject to them. You get protection if you are acting as a uniformed soldier on behalf of your country. But that's not available to these guys. So instead, if, you know, and I'm not sure that there has to be a written law that would be applied here, but if under the law of Mothra's island, they get fed to Mothra for having killed some villagers, I think they're out of luck. They get fed to Mothra.
You know, I'd be fine with that result. It wouldn't bother me. Unusual, sure, but might be common where they are. So, oops. don't do that. Don't kidnap people to make them slaves, which raises the big issue of human trafficking, because the peanuts are taken and put into a stage production. They're forced to do vaudeville. And,
yes.
You know, there's the 1926 convention against the slave trade, which the United States is a part of, Japan's a part of. I mean, it's just, and again, that's pre-World War II, so it's not like this wasn't on the books by 1961.
Yeah.
So the idea that the international community said no to human trafficking was strong and been around for a while, because we're not okay with this. And there is no doubt that they were being made slaves. And Nelson says, well, they don't speak Japanese. You don't know that they're not happy. And they quickly find out that, you know, when the heroes go to visit with the twins, there's telepathy. The twins communicate like, no, we're not okay. Mothra's coming and we're sad. You good ones are also going to die. And it's like, what? You good ones? So that means the country of Japan is all going to get pummeled because of the acts of Nelson and his goons, because a rescue's coming in the form of a giant moth that's now really upset.
Yeah, Mothra does not do, let's say, surgical strikes.
No, this is not Mothra looking just for one dude. Everyone in her way is going to take a beating, because those are big wings. There's lots of air movement. Everyone gets hit. And so again, it's definitely not okay. Which then, since we're on the subject of slavery, we had some unpleasantness in the United States that culminated with the Civil War. We got the 13th Amendment and the 14th out of this, and the 15th. Want to talk about the 13th Amendment?
I do. So I'm so glad you asked me, Josh. The 13th Amendment doesn't come up as often as it should, because it's a very special amendment. It's obviously, in case anyone isn't aware, the 13th Amendment is the amendment abolishing slavery. However, it is not only special for that, for the act that it abolishes slavery, but it's special for the way in which it does so. So pretty much every other part of U.S. federal law in the Constitution is a protection that you have against the government. It's a prohibition of the government doing something to you. So for example, freedom of speech isn't actually, there shall be freedom of speech in the United States. The First Amendment says that the freedom of speech shall not be abridged by Congress. 13th Amendment, on the other hand, simply does say neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, this is an important caveat, which I think we should fix, except as punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. And then there's a second clause empowering Congress to enforce it by appropriate legislation. That's similar to the 14th Amendment. Section 1, though, is very special, because in theory, a private citizen could violate the 13th Amendment by trying to hold someone as a slave, or even by trying to be a slave. For example, it disallows voluntary slavery, if there is such a thing, right? So you couldn't sell yourself into slavery if you wanted to. And this is kind of important in Mothra, because Nelson's, one of the things he says in his defense is they're obviously enjoying themselves when they're doing this sing-song dance for me. But the 13th Amendment does not care about that. We do not care if someone is enjoying themselves while they're working for no wages. And we also don't care even if, in theory, someone actually wanted to go sell themselves into slavery. It is forbidden. And it is not just forbidden in the U.S. It's forbidden anywhere we have jurisdiction. So this kind of came up in litigation about, for example, Guantanamo, which is technically not part of the United States, but was found to be under its jurisdiction. So a limited number of rights that apply anywhere the U.S. has jurisdiction applies in Guantanamo, and 13th Amendment would be one of them.
Yeah, there's a lot of unpleasantness here, because Nelson is a very, very bad man. And
he is not one of the good ones.
No, absolutely not. It's just, evil capitalist has money. And what do? I'm putting on a stage production now. That is so weird. I mean, just like the cause effect of we're going to do live shows in Japan.
I know. And it was also, why are people buying tickets?
What? They're lovely singing voices. I mean,
there should be a picket line outside of that theater saying that these women are being exploited.
I mean, it's borderline like King Kong with people go to
see
ape because of it's a curiosity. And it's like, hey, these women are three apples tall. They speak in unison. They sing songs and they're going to fly in a little carriage. Okay. Like that does sound like dinner in an evening. And let's go. And it's a happy anniversary, but it's just fundamentally wrong. It's not saying Celine Dion in Vegas. It is a bad thing and you shouldn't do it. No. So after finding out from the twins that they are not happy and telling this to reporters, what do? The reporters print it in their newspaper. So what happens? Nelson and his head legal goon show up and threaten the newspaper for telling the truth and say, you printed a story that I'm holding the twins against their will, and I'm going to sue you. The reaction should be, bring it on, because I look forward to civil discovery where I depose the twins one at a time to make sure that they're not happy with being your slave, and also to find out how you're treating them. So yeah,
right.
Bring it on. Look forward to it. There's a line that one of the characters says that's pretty on point. And what was your reaction to that?
So I was so thrilled with this. When Nelson initially, his legal goon, which I appreciate, I think that is the exact opposite of a legal geek. His legal goon threatens to sue. I'm trying to remember his name, but the main reporter character, Bulldog, sorry, as I believe he's nicknamed, replies with, "What are you going to sue me for? The truth?" And this was perfect because not only is it obviously a pithy response by a hero character, but it is also actually a correct statement of the absolute defense to any defamation suit, which is truth. So it wasn't always this way, by the way. I believe that truth as an absolute defense was not originally a defense in common law, but it's been enacted throughout the United States and now in pretty much every common law country, such that you cannot sue someone for defamation if it is the truth. Defamation, by the way, encapsulates both slander, which is verbal telling of things that are damage your reputation, and in this case, libel, which is defamation in written form. But yeah, so as an absolute defense, all you have to do is establish the truth of something. This has come up in somewhat hilarious fashion in some suits over the years. I believe there was in the very famous Cato amicus brief, when John Oliver's show was sued for making fun of a coal magnate, in which they did a comical reenactment of his story about a squirrel coming to him to talk about, you should start a coal company. One of the things that he tried to sue them for was comparing him to a geriatric Dr. Evil. The Cato brief on this illustrated this perfectly by simply saying, truth is an absolute defense.
And there are those who say lawyers don't have a sense of humor. Which then introduces the litigation privilege, highlighting the fact that Nelson is a public figure because he's not a public official, but he's a public figure.
He has entered himself into the public arena. There's some interesting questions about people who sort of are thrust into becoming public figures involuntarily, but he has done it himself.
He's internationally known as this man of mystery.
He's doing this big show in which he's trying to garner publicity.
So just looking at Times v. Sullivan, because that's one of the gold standards that's quoted over and over in this, for those who are playing First Amendment bingo, the United States Supreme Court held in a libel suit brought by a public official, the First Amendment requires that a plaintiff to show that in publishing the defamatory statement that the defendant acted with malice, with knowledge that it was false or reckless disregard of whether it was false or not. And that that must be shown with convincing clarity. So what they published was true. This isn't like one of those false light cases, which again, isn't, not every state has. And even then, it's still publishing the truth.
Right. But they actually didn't even, so in this case, it was true, but they didn't even actually need to have turned out to have been publishing the truth. The actual malice standard, people listening to this might think that that sounds like it's a pretty harsh phrase, and it is. It's supposed to be very difficult to prove. Basically, it can be summarized as the party attempting to sue for defamation will have to show that the newspaper or the journalist had some kind of reckless disregard for the truth or falsity of what they were publishing, or they literally knew that it wasn't true. It's very difficult to prove that somebody really knew something wasn't true. So usually you're more trying to prove that they were having this kind of wanton behavior without caring about whether or not it was true. But either one is very difficult to prove, and it's supposed to be that way.
Exactly. And suing the media, you know, legitimate reporters, it's supposed to be hard, you know, but those who say, well, that school shooting, those were just crisis actors and none of it was really happening, was a false flag. Those lawsuits go forward for a reason.
Yeah.
Because it's reckless. It's reckless disregard for the truth. And there are several pending in the country right now because of things that have happened.
And I do want to highlight that this isn't strictly a sort of, there isn't a strict political valence on this either. There are just some times when journalists or media companies just really do things wrong. So I actually, my old law firm, my first job with Kirkland & Ellis, Kirkland & Ellis actually originally back in like turn of the 20th century Chicago used to make its one of its bread and butters by suing the Chicago Tribune for defamation. And so as a result, they kept the reputation for being, you know, defending large corporations, except they were generally plaintiff side when suing media companies. And some of the more famous ones that they, suits that they have won against media companies include a lawsuit by GM against, I think it was NBC, I could be getting that wrong, but a huge news network, for a show involving, or a special they did involve, which supposedly showed that GM's latest truck literally would spontaneously explode. And as it turns out, the person doing the story had actually taped explosives to the bottoms of the trucks. I mean, so that's just an example that there can sometimes be this kind of ridiculous conduct, and people do get sued and they win, and the plaintiffs sometimes win. But it is the exception, not the rule, for a reason, because we don't want to accidentally chill people into not reporting things that they're pretty sure are true because they're so worried about getting sued.
Which then brings us to anti-SLAPP litigation.
Yes. So most states, not all, but most states have enacted anti-SLAPP statutes. I believe, I'm trying to remember, SLAPP, I believe, stands for something litigation.
Strategic
speech litigation. Yeah, go ahead. You do it.
Strategic litigation against?
I think it's public petitions, but anyway, or public participation, that's it. But basically the idea is that if somebody is suing you for some First Amendment, otherwise First Amendment protected activity, so publishing something, petitioning your government, things like that, those kinds of very clearly enshrined by the First Amendment activities, you can raise a defense under an anti-SLAPP statute, which at least at the very beginning of a lawsuit will shift the burden back to the person who's suing. Ordinarily, right, if you're being sued, you have certain burdens to produce evidence in civil lawsuits. Instead, in this case, right now, instead of having it be your burden to show that their lawsuit should be dismissed because it fails to state a claim or something like that, instead, before the motion to dismiss, which is ordinarily the earliest stage, you can earliest stage at which a lawsuit can be decided, you can shift it back to the person who's suing you to show that it's not frivolous, to show that there is merit in their lawsuit. They don't have to prove it, but they have to show that it's meritorious if they fail to do so and the lawsuit is terminated at that juncture, they're on the hook to pay your legal fees. So it's essentially there in order to prevent people from using process as its own punishment. Right. So if you sue someone, especially, let's say, a small newspaper that doesn't have tons of money for its own defense, doesn't have its own legal department, you might be able to get them to retract a story, even if they know it's true, just because they can't afford to defend themselves. And so the anti-SLAPP is supposed to specifically address that concern, so that if there's a really frivolous lawsuit, there's no way that a newspaper is going to get intimidated out of running their story.
Because that's just not American. Not how we do business. We don't do that here. Other things that we don't do is pistol whip kids and tie them up. That happens in this movie, and it's super uncomfortable.
So Josh, is there any circumstance under which people should pistol whip children?
No. We shouldn't have a PSA that says don't pistol whip a child, but if we need one, sure, there's some Hollywood actors that will make one, because we have Hero Kid, and I couldn't.
Josh, by the way, Josh and I tried really hard to find his name without necessarily going through the movie all over again, and it's surprisingly hard. I don't know why, but Hero Kid. We'll call him Hero Kid.
Yeah, he's got the baseball cap on. He's wearing a jacket, so he meets all the check boxes for the kaiju movie Hero Kid, and. You know, in a good sense of right and wrong, of like, it's wrong to put the ladies in a cage.
Yes.
I'm going to go save them. Do you know what? Good impulse, kid. That was the right thing. And what's he going to do? I'm going to go to the theater and I'm going to go rescue the girls. Again.
Right. And I appreciate this because the adults are all trying to find, legalistic ways of retrieving the women here. The kid just decides, screw it. I'm going to go fix this problem.
And I appreciate the adults trying to figure out how do we legally do this, but there's something adorable about the kid. I'm going to go take on a bunch of goons and try to save the day.
Let's change the status quo. They can sue me to get the girls back, and good luck finding a court who's going to do that.
So he sneaks in, and he does get them out of, they're basically in a Faraday cage.
Yeah.
So their telepathic signal can't be sent to Mothra, and he tries getting them out, but tries going out the front door where like five goons see him. So appreciate the
correct effort. Impulses. Yeah, not the best plan.
Bless his heart. It goes sideways fast. Well, he gets caught. They tie him up, gag him, and knock him out. And then they leave his body hidden. It is messed up. So it's like
Okay, so for our listeners, this is obviously wrong. However, this does present an opportunity. Again, this is kind of as an issue spotter. This presents an opportunity to discuss one legal concept, which is shopkeeper's privilege. So ordinarily, private citizens have extremely limited legal protections when it comes to detaining other private citizens. One exception to that is state by state, so not all states have enacted shopkeeper's privileges. But one is shopkeeper's privilege. And in some states where they have this privilege, it basically means that a person who owns a business can, if they're being reasonable, detain someone that they suspect has committed a crime within their premises, such as usually shoplifting. In this case, right, technically, if we again just set aside the huge glaring problem of human trafficking and holding people against their will, Nelson considers these women to be his property. So, Hero Kid is stealing something, perhaps. But so ordinarily, shopkeeper's privilege would allow a shopkeeper to detain someone using reasonable force. So if someone is resisting you or something, you're allowed to use a little bit of force. You are definitely not allowed to, after you have detained them, so after the kid has been wrestled into a chair, that's the point at which they pistol whip him, so that's definitely a no-go, even under shopkeeper's privilege. And then the other really important caveat here is you're only allowed to hold them for as long as it takes you to perform a quick, reasonable investigation to determine if they did, in fact, steal something, or to get law enforcement, actual law enforcement there. The other, the last super, and of course that also is broken here because they don't release him. They just leave him there and then abandon the building. So that also breaks down. And then the last really important caveat. So in every privilege in which a private citizen gets some kind of defense when they're detaining another private citizen, unlike with police officers, where a law enforcement officer is immune from civil liability if they detain someone and it turns out they didn't commit a crime, so long as they had a probable cause to believe that they had or were committing a crime, that does not go for private citizens who are detaining someone pursuant to shopkeeper's privilege or the slightly related concept of citizen's arrest. You have to be right. You don't have the benefit of the, oh, I had reasonable suspicion or I had probable cause to think they were stealing something. If it turns out you were wrong, you are on the hook for every civil liability for everything that you did, including false imprisonment and, in this case, battery.
Yeah, it's just so many things wrong because it's this pinata of definitely false imprisonment, definitely battery, possibly
kidnapping.
If they move the kid from one room to another, it's now kidnapping. If the kid stayed in the room, I think it's just false imprisonment is the way that the logic would break down because he's not moved.
Still real bad.
Still real bad. And all that. It's a kid who's trying to save girls that you're holding in slavery. So there's that.
Yeah, it's an opportunity for me to wax geek about legal concepts, but no, there's no universe in which this is legally defensible.
It's all bad. It is very, very bad. Which then brings us to the public turn against Nelson, because he's no longer the Renaissance man explorer who has a unique vaudeville show. He now has women against their will, and their giant angry god is ravaging the countryside and destroying things. And that generally does not go well with public opinion, because the public's now super not on board. So when, you know, there are radio reports about, we're on the lookout for Nelson, and he's spotted. There's a mob. Now, you might wonder, well, Josh, tell me, what's the legal definition of a mob? And I would say to thee, it is when people, and the definition is...
two or more persons, I believe.
At least two. So in different states, break this down, because you could have, you know, different levels of mob.
Is it a level 3 mob, a level 4 mob? How much experience do you need to level up your mob?
Yeah, and I think that's New York that breaks it down that way. But but yeah, so like it increases with numbers. But, you know, that they're disturbing the public peace. This kind of is that. Now, the public here is a wee bit sensitive to what's going on because, again, the giant moth flying overhead has disturbed everyone's sense of zen. Nobody's calm right now. And it's like, you brought this on us, dude. People are dead because of you. So they don't go like full pitchforks and torches on him, but there is this, get him. And he draws a gun. So he holds people off. And I think he strikes at least one person, like knocks an old man's cane down, stuff like
that. Oh, yeah. Which was so unnecessary.
It's just mean. And, well, police shoot him. So, like, he doesn't get far. And you know what? That's, I would say, lawful use of police force because he had a gun and he was threatening others.
Yeah. It's not just, so it's important that it's not just that he had a gun, but it's that he had a gun. He was pointing it at people in the immediate vicinity. And when you have a deadly firearm like that, I think it's reasonable to interpret that if you're pointing it at people, you're threatening their lives. But was also his behavior was also extremely erratic. He was waving the gun at people. But yes, this is contrasted with our discussion at the beginning of the show about use of force in self-defense. This was a pretty good example of use of deadly force by law enforcement. And I believe they even after he pulled the gun, they did give him a lot of warning with, you know, drop the gun. This is not going to end well for you. And gave him some opportunity, which he maybe didn't actually deserve. but it was a good example of use of force by law enforcement.
Yeah. And, you know, they shoot the bad guy and they get the girls back and things are okay. And there's
more or less, for the smoldering ruin that is Newkirk City.
Yeah. And oh God, the paperwork, the insurance claims. And just, and then the unpleasant international relations, because we have the Rossellian government that initially backed Nelson.
Yeah. So,
are they on the hook to the people of Japan? It's like, you clowns backed your moron who kidnapped women in violation of international law, and a giant moth ravaged our country because of you schmucks. Pay up.
So I think they would be on the hook, but I think only in the sense of diplomatically, because this is an important thing to think about. They made noises to Japan about, you know, you must respect the property rights of our citizens, but they didn't actually have any power to protect him. I don't believe Rilisikin military or anyone ever showed up at his theater to defend him against Japanese police, which would have been a huge international incident. So from a practical standpoint, I agree with you. There's going to be hell to pay for the Rilisikin government diplomatically. But I think it's important to emphasize that in that scene in which, you know, the Rilisikin government is communicating to Japan, you know, we are standing up for our citizen, you must respect his property rights, that was all diplomatic noise. If Japan had, if a Japanese court or Japanese law enforcement had decided to intervene there, this was, a Rilisikin citizen, but on Japanese soil, the property, quote-unquote property, that was claimed in dispute was on Japanese soil. So there was no problem of personal jurisdiction. There was no problem of enforcing an order by a Japanese court or a Japanese law enforcement officer. They could have. And again, the Rilisikin government could have made diplomatic noise, like said, you know, we're going to break off formal relations with you if you don't intervene to stop this, which again is ridiculous. Why would they if they knew what was going on here? So it was a little bit much that they decided to intervene at all at first. But yeah, so in that sense, I don't think this is quite the same as, like, you know, I don't see Japan being able to try to create, liability for the Rilisikin government here, because they made noises, but they didn't actually do anything to prevent the Japanese government from taking the girls. And they should have. They really should have.
This is like an ethics 101. It's like, why do you think that's okay? It's just...
I know. I think the only reason they did it is because the director told them to, like, to create the narrative tension.
They needed the story, because if everything... Hey, everything's okay. Like...
Yeah, exactly. If this had been a real-life scenario, they would have resolved this quickly by just seizing the twins and freeing them.
Nope. We're not going there. Or the twins would have never left the island to begin with. And then, you know, then it would be a different movie that we need to figure out. Which is why when you look at, say, Godzilla versus Mothra, which was bringing the two together, you know, it's the issue of the egg in that one. And again, mild issues with the twins getting kidnapped again, and
someone trying to buy them, right? You know, if I remember.
How much for the girls? Like, what? Screw you. And again, the fact that happened twice as a plot.
I know. The only other time I've had the chance to talk about the 13th Amendment at length is with Mothra versus Godzilla. So.
Super uncomfortable. It's like, oh my God. Why does this keep happening to those ladies?
I know, it's like as soon as you have a person, but they're 6 inches tall, just people can't seem to see them as people anymore. Like, I'm not quite sure, there's a whole slew of villains that seem to be unable to see them as people, and lots of good guys who still do, but...
You get the evil capitalists who are, you know, it's like, we would have put on stage shows. We want to open an amusement park. Really? Is that so? there are better ways to make money that don't involve exploiting people. Maybe you should check those out.
I know, yeah.
Just going to go out on a limb here that it's better for morale, you know, and...
Also better for not having a huge civil liabilities.
You are the bad guy in the story. Are you comfortable with that?
Yeah.
So that's the film. And it's a wonderful film. I do enjoy the effects. It's fun. And there's just a plethora of legal issues that we've covered with it.
There's so many more that we could have gotten to, and you know, like invasion of privacy. Were they taking secret pictures of the scientist when he dropped the newspaper with the lighter? There's a million things that we could get to.
Yeah, there's a lot there. Do one on rights of the media and the press.
Right, which is super fun. I happen to love talking about First Amendment issues.
Stowaways, which would be a fun one to research as well. So yes.
Mm-hmm.
How far can they go for a story? But a lot there. That said, this is another Ishiro Honda classic, and rightfully so.
Yeah, I really loved this movie. And I highly recommend it. You can stream it on Amazon Prime right now, if anyone is curious.
Yeah, there's other, you know, Blu-rays and DVDs of it and other ways to watch it as well. But it is fun. And it's nice to see where the classics originate from. And
definitely, because I did see in the latest Godzilla, when Mothra made her appearance, that was actually the first time that I've seen Mothra on camera. So it was really great to, quote unquote, on camera, on the big screen. It was great to see where it all started, because I've been in love with Mothra for a few years now.
Yes, I'm glad I could introduce you to. It's a good thing. It's a very good thing. So with that, everyone continue to stay safe, stay healthy. We will be back with more legal analysis of kaiju and other fun topics in the weeks ahead. And everyone, be well. Take care now.